I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Joe Illick. He's director of the Santa Fe Concert Association, and he's here with Richard Rood, who's a violinist. He's one of the concert masters of Orpheus in New York City, of the Santa Fe Opera, and of the Santa Fe Concert Association. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you. Let's talk about what's happening tonight at 7:30 at the United Church of Santa Fe. You do a series of notes on music, which are kind of performance talks.
Exactly. This has turned into a popular series. I take a composer or some aspect of music and talk about it with demonstrations sitting at the piano, but I'm no violinist, so this concert this evening, this performance this evening, is about all about the violin. And so what better way to show everybody about the violin than to have one of the best violinists I know come in and perform? That's why Richard is here with us.
Excellent. So how does this actually work? You're going to talk about the history of the instrument itself?
I think Joe is going to basically handle the speaking, and I'm going to be there to illustrate some of the example that he's giving.
Yeah, we'll take the history of the violin, and then we'll look. The violin appears sort of in the early 1500s in northern Italy. And oddly, the violins that were created by the early 1700s haven't been equaled since then.
You know, what's
up with that? Well, they put a lot of time and thought and thousands of violins into, you know, everybody knows the name Stradivarius, and Stradivari worked on thousands of violins just to test different kinds of wood, and thousands more just to test different shapes, and he finally worked it out. He did more than work it out. He figured out how to, I mean, there were other great violin makers too, but you know, in the 19th and 20th centuries, people were still clamoring for those Stradivarius violins.
And is there like a lost art part of it? Nobody's figured out what he did?
They know literally what he did, but the craftsmanship was exquisite, and he was lucky enough to have a huge independent income and live to be 90, and he just devoted every cell of his being to making the greatest violins.
It's funny how that is an art that gives rise to an art.
There is a whole art to it, and without a great instrument, the greatest violin playing can't happen.
Now, for a violinist like you, what's the lay of the land like today? I mean, not everybody can get a Stradivarius violin.
Yeah, it's unfortunately out of the price range for most performers. A lot of the great instruments are owned by foundations and collectors and are lent to terrific players. There are also some really good modern makers, and in between, you know, the history of violin making, that we play on a lot of different sorts of instruments.
And so you, as a violinist, and all violinists of a certain caliber, probably know that handful of violin makers worldwide.
Yeah, absolutely.
And bow makers, don't forget. You can't play the violin without a bow.
Well, let's talk about bows. Well, we still have to get into the history of the violin, but what's a bow made of, and how has that evolved or stayed the same over the last half millennium?
Yeah, bows, as Joe was saying, you know, with the violins, the pinnacle, the peak of violin making was in Cremona in the early 1700s, late 1600s. And with bows, it was in Paris, late 1700s, where Francois Tourte really was maybe the greatest bow maker of all time. And he defined the length of the bow, the kind of wood, as you mentioned, which is Pernambuco, which is from South America. And so virtually all the bows are made from Pernambuco.
What is the requirement of the wood in a bow? What does it have to do?
It has to have a sort of resiliency so that when we're drawing the bow across the string, it has horsehair, which it comes in contact with the string. But you need a certain amount of strength, but you need a certain amount of flexibility. And it's that sort of balance that the Pernambuco has really been the best wood anybody's ever come up with.
And all sorts of other woods have been tried and rejected.
Absolutely.
And what about the hair? I mean, it's always a horse tail?
Yeah, it's amazingly, yeah. It's usually Mongolian of some sort, Chinese horse hair. And
American horses don't cut it either.
I'm not aware of the hair coming from
America. There's a historical reason, too. There were a lot of string instruments back to the Egyptians, but it seems to be the Mongolians who first came across the idea of a bow, which, of course, produces a sustained sound instead of a plucked sound. And the Mongolians knew everything about horses, so these little two-string early violin prototypes, you know, 1,000 years ago, the Mongolians used horsehair for these bows.
So the first violins were proto-violins were Mongolian?
You know, lots of different people claim them, and it's not historically documented, but that's a strong contender for the first bow use on a stringed instrument.
Now, they haven't come up with any synthetic fibers that are stronger and better? No.
Mm-mm. I mean, if there was as much need for horse tail wigs as there is for human wigs, I'm sure that science would have come up with that. But
yeah,
the need has been less pressing because horses aren't as demanding about their cosmetic appearance.
We're talking about the violin in advance of the Notes on Music series, whose season starts tonight at the United Church of Santa Fe. Okay, so the first proto-violins, do any of these exist, these Mongolian instruments that you were talking about?
Yes, they do.
What do they look like?
They look like boxes with two strings over a little hole. All of those features, the shape of the stringed instrument, the hole, the shape of the hole, the way the string, you know, the bridge, which seems a natural idea to us, was unknown to all these old proto-violins. Figuring out that there could be a bridge was a big jump. Just the way figuring out there could be a bow was a big jump. Then figuring out that if the sides of the instrument had a little less space so that the bow could be maneuvered through that area was a big jump. You
Hence
know how the
those
violin has that eight shape. Yeah, the indentations on the side of a violin allow the bow to go down there. Otherwise, it would bump into the instrument.
Right, right. Now, what happened then? How did this whole violin concept go to Europe?
It went into Genoa and Venice because those ports were international. And so Asia and Europe came together in northern Italy. And the Italians used the violin, or original violins, for dance music. It wasn't originally people sitting in orchestras playing composed pieces. And so probably very little of that music is written down. It would either be the violinist playing along with the singer or simply playing dance tunes. But gradually, as the first groups of string players came together, these ensembles and then small orchestras, the violin became the dominant instrument in the orchestra, which it still is.
Why is the violin the dominant instrument in the orchestra?
You know, I may be, because I'm a violinist, a little bit, you know, skewed on
this. Oh, lay it, just tell it like it is.
But the violin really, in my opinion, is really sort of the most advanced instrument ever conceived. It's capable of the most expression, more so than any other instrument. So composers tended to gravitate towards the violins having melodic leadership in their pieces.
Then you've got all the other violin-like instruments that get lower and lower in tone.
Right.
That are larger and larger violins, basically.
Right.
Basically.
Yeah. The violin family, you know, the violas, the cellos, the bass.
That are equally able to have that range of expression that you're talking about?
They're not, really. The best double bass players in the world have certainly made solo careers, but you can just look around and see that there are fewer double bass concertos and fewer double bass soloists. There's nothing that you can do to alter the physics of the fact that as tone gets lower and lower, it has less flexibility.
So you could make a case for the cello, couldn't you?
Of course, and there's a lot more cello literature than there is, say, double bass literature. And the cello is a beautiful instrument, but I think that the violin does have the most expressive possibilities and is the most highly developed instrument of any instrument.
And that is reflected in all the compositions for violin.
Yep.
Right.
So who were the first composers who really took this instrument to the fullness of its expressive possibilities?
They were Italians, Corelli, Vivaldi, Tartini. Who else comes to mind?
Even Bach, you know, in the solo sonatas, it really hasn't been surpassed what he was able to conceive of a solo violin being able to do technically.
And then it evolved, of course, over the...
It evolved as the Industrial Revolution changed life in the world. You know, the violins, when we say somebody owns a Stradivarius, nobody owns the exact instrument that Stradivarius made, because violins had to be refitted to be able to make more sound as concert halls grew and as audiences grew. String instruments would have been originally for, you know, a king's court, and so we were in a smaller space. Now we're in concert halls with 1,500, 2,500, even 3,000 seats. So
what did they do to the instruments?
Well, the body, the belly and the back stay the same, but the fingerboard was raised, and the strings were positioned so that they were in more of an arc and less flat.
Now, tell us about the strings. What were those made of historically, and
intestines.
What are they now?
Well, they're still sometimes intestines.
Yeah.
Intestines of whom?
It's called catgut, but it's not a cat's gut. It's
no.
Usually sheep or goats. Could be horses, I'm sure, for the Mongolians. No, I'm kidding about that.
And are they still gut?
Yeah, well, no, there
are
synthetic strings.
Yeah, we use a synthetic core strings that are wound, like... other instruments at this point. And it's partly out of this desire to produce more volume for the larger concert halls, as Joe was saying.
Right.
And that's kind of the one of the amazing things about Stradivarius and his success as a maker, is that the instruments were able to adapt over the centuries to these larger concert halls, and also to the more complex music. Even I mentioned Francois Tort, that sort of defined the violin bow around 1800. He was working closely with the virtuoso violinists of his time and trying to create a bow that could be used to really execute this virtuoso music that was starting to be written. And once again, I mean, the bows just haven't been surpassed, really.
We're talking to Joe Illick and Richard Rood about the violin. So I imagine that even at the beginning of this illustrious history of the violin, virtuoso violin players were, first of all, stars, and second, very much in competition with each other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, it was part of the fabric of the societies in Europe, especially. And then by the time we hit the 1900 or something, then there were various places, for instance, in Russia, that where Yasha Heifetz came out of, and these sort of centers of performance activity and growth as they produce these virtuosos.
When I was in high school, I had a friend who'd grown up in Hungary, and she told me that in kindergarten in Hungary, every child had a violin. If they didn't have one at home, the school gave them one, but it was just common. And they all played.
Oh, my goodness.
So there are certain cultural centers where violin playing is integral to the way that society lives.
Amazing.
Eastern Europe, Russia, yeah.
Yeah, it's like every school child in Bali plays gamelan.
There you go.
Can you imagine if we had an instrument that every single child in the United States played?
If you could make an orchestra out of video games, we would be the world leaders in that orchestra.
Oh, Lord. Yes, indeed. So let's talk more about what you're going to be actually playing tonight. I mean, when you do these
works
notes
by
on music.
Handel, Grieg, Debussy, and César Franck.
In their entirety or
movements.
Pieces of the...
Single
okay.
movements, yeah.
For solo violin?
For violin and piano.
For violin and piano. So basically, we get to hear the two of you doing a concert of music for violin and piano.
You do.
With kind of historical background
commentary,
and
yes.
commentary.
I think we should listen to some violin playing
after
all this talking.
Oh, let's do that.
We performed a concert in August of last year, August of 2011, and the soloist was a young woman named Caroline Golding. This is an excerpt of her playing some of the first movement of Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto.
Thank you.
Violin Concerto in D Major by Tchaikovsky, performed by the Santa Fe Concert Association.
Yeah, we had a gala concert in August of 2011, and our soloist was a young woman. She was 18 at the time of the performance you just heard, named Caroline Golding. She's now on her way to a world career. And what you didn't hear is that in the finale of that concerto, something that happens to violinists happened on stage. One of her pegs slipped and her string went completely slack, and she couldn't have continued to play on her Stradivarius violin. So she looked at Richard, who's sitting here beside me, and Richard in a half a second knew what had happened. So they swapped violins in a 5-second silence.
Oh my goodness.
And Richard patiently fixed her violin while she went on and finished the concerto.
Oh,
it was
goodness.
Great.
Yeah, playing my violin.
Playing his violin.
How different is it to play somebody else's violin?
It's quite a bit different, but, you know, her technique is really strong, and she was able to adapt really quickly.
And it beats the alternative, which is singing your way to the end of the concerto, you know.
Yes, indeed. Now, learning to play the violin, which I have to admit, I did try to do that in the third grade, along with a whole bunch of other elementary school kids in our quite decent school music program. I mean, it's hard, and you don't sound good when you're, I mean,
yeah,
do any people sound?
No, I think even the Yasha Heifetzes of this world have to make scratchy noises for a few days, and for most of us it's a few years before any beautiful sounds come out of that violin.
How did you start?
I grew up in Cleveland. I started when I was about 7 years old. I actually heard a performance at my elementary school, and another student was playing who is now in the Emerson String Quartet, which is, you know, maybe the premier string quartet in America. And I went home and told my parents I'd heard this thing, this violin, and that I really wanted to have one and learn to play it.
And what did they say?
And then, oh, that was also kind of surprising. My father went up to the closet, pulled out a couple of violins, and started to play them. And I had no idea that he could play the violin on any level.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and I'd never seen him play the violin, but he had, you know, had learned sort of an amateur level. But he practiced with me a great deal when I was a kid, and it was very helpful.
And so did it come easily to you? Did it come naturally?
The violin is a difficult instrument, and it certainly takes time. I always loved the sound of the violin, and I loved playing the violin. There were certainly periods where, like most kids, I wasn't exactly enamored with practicing so much every day. But I got through that, and actually at this stage now, you know, I've performed a lot. In a certain way, practicing is one of the most gratifying things, because there's no pressure, there's no critics, it's me. And I can stand there, and if it didn't go perfectly, well, just do it again.
Let's talk about Paganini, because you can't talk about the violin without talking about Paganini.
Right. Every instrument has its heroes, and one of the great heroes of the violin was an Italian named Niccolò Paganini, who in the early part of the 1800s was the unquestioned great violinist of the world. People were so disbelieving that he could do the things that he did on a violin that they even thought he was in league with the devil.
Right.
And when he died in 1840, the Catholic Church refused to give him a burial because they thought that would be like signing a pact with Satan.
Just because he was a good player?
It was more than a good player. Somebody once set him a sight-reading challenge of something that they thought was impossible, and he played it all on one string just to show off.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, he could, obviously, there are no recordings, but from everybody's account, including the other great musicians of the time, like Schumann and Berlioz and Liszt, he could do anything with the violin.
One thing that one notices if one has been watching the Olympics decade after decade is that they just keep getting better and better. Does that happen in music? Are people more virtuosic? Are there more virtuosos?
I think the general level gets better and better. That's for certain. And the pool of people, too, these days has increased so much, especially in the violin world with all the Asian players, the Japanese, Koreans, and Chinese now. Just tremendous amounts of these players. And the training continues to get better. The teaching is getting better. You know, we've had 300 years to figure out how to negotiate this instrument. Yeah, so the general level is just really pretty phenomenal right now.
But there aren't any Paganinis.
But there are outliers in every... Well, again, we haven't heard Paganini. We haven't heard Franz Liszt. We don't know what the standard was at that time.
Right.
And so it's impossible to comment on that, except to know that even to the other superb musicians of his era, he was regarded as a phenomenon. I suspect that the general technical level of playing that one hears today would exceed Franz Liszt and exceed Niccolò Paganini. But we also have to remember in a cultural context that classical music was central to people's lives at that time in a way that, alas, it is not today.
Alas.
So a Paganini or a Liszt was reaching out to everybody just the way, you know, the most famous movie star or pop star is now.
Well, should we hear another piece of music before we go?
I think that's a great idea. This is one more excerpt from one of our concerts. Our Christmas Eve concert in 2011 began with a wonderful young violinist. And when I say young, she's 13 in this recording, Jackie Cho from Cincinnati. She performed the Mendelssohn Concerto with us. And I think the best thing would be to listen to the finale of that concerto. And that was Jackie Cho performing the finale of Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto.
Quite amazing, these young players playing the violin. It's time to go, but tonight at 7:30 at the United Church of Santa Fe at 1804 Arroyo Treviso, it's the first of this season's Notes on Music with Joe Illick, director of the Santa Fe Concert Association. And you'll be doing more of these as the season goes on?
Yes. On November 5th, the day before Election Day, I'm going to do one on Debussy.
Nice.
With my wife Jenna, who's a fantastic singer. So we'll do piano music, vocal music, and everything you ever wanted to know about Debussy. And then in early 2013, the 200th anniversary of Wagner's birth, on January 29th, I do one on Wagner with a Wagnerian soprano, Karen Foster. So if you're wondering all about Richard Wagner, that's the night to find out.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. And thank you, violinist Richard Rood. And we will see you tonight.
Great. Thank you.
And for more information, you can call 984-8759, Santa Fe Concert Association. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Jason Silverman. He's the director of the CCA Cinematheque. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
And by phone, Michael Stearns. He's composer for the music of the new film Samsara, which is opening tonight at the Lensic. It's a one-night-only performance in advance of the run at the CCA. Welcome, Michael, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm glad to be here.
So this is a film that's part of, I guess what you would call it, a pretty small genre of non-narrative, non-verbal, non-linear documentaries. It's such an interesting form, and there aren't a whole lot of people who do it. Talk about this form and what it's like to work on a film that's in this kind of a format.
Well, it actually, this genre started here in Santa Fe with Godfrey Reggio and Ron Fricke and Alton Walpole working on Koyaanisqatsi. So the roots of it are really right here in Santa Fe. Evidently some of my music was used as temp music for Koyaanisqatsi, and that's how Ron and Alton found out about me. And so in 1983, I was asked to score their first project that they did together that was an IMAX project called Kronos. And it was a nonverbal film of the genre. And so I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I'd always wanted to work in the medium of IMAX. And I ended up scoring Kronos, and then it's kind of just, you know, we've all been like family since then. Several years later, we did Baraka, 1992, that was released. And then there's been kind of a big gap here, 20 years, and Samsara has just been released, although they've been out in the field shooting Samsara for the last 5 years. They shot in 24 countries around the world.
That's amazing. So you go to 24 countries to get what might end up being really small amounts of footage that get used in the final film.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, a lot of the film is in time-lapse. That's kind of the technology that started the whole thing with Koyaanisqatsi and then, you know, all the way through to this film. Although there's a lot of regular 24 frames per second footage. This was shot in 70 millimeter on 70 millimeter film. So, you know, sometimes they would go for 2 days, like out into a village in the middle of Namibia somewhere, and shoot a time lapse sequence that would actually only end up being like 15 seconds on the screen.
Right. Talk about the title. The title Samsara, that's a Tibetan word, which is about kind of the cycles of life. Is that right?
Yeah, Samsara describes the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. And it also refers to this realm that we call Earth or planet Earth as the realm of impermanence, where nothing is permanent, everything is always changing.
And so when you compose your music for it, what is that process like? What is the relationship between the... I mean, is the film fully edited by the time you're composing or not? What's that like?
Well, it really has been different with each project. Starting with Kronos, I actually wrote the music. I saw some of the roughs of the footage unedited completely, and then I was kind of set off on my own after a couple of long conversations with the director, Ron Fricke, and spent 3 months writing the score and recording the score, and then they came back after 4 or 5 months with a lot of new footage and edited the footage to the music. Baraka was kind of a mix of that sort of process and also my looking at rough edits and then writing music to the rough edits. But Samsara was done very differently. The entire film was edited. Well, it was edited in blocks. When you see the film, you'll see that there are certain themes in different parts of the film. And so those themes are what I'm calling the blocks. And they were actually edited completely in silence, almost like a Zen meditation, not edited to music at all. And then I was brought in about a year and a half ago, or actually about 2 years ago at this point, and I was shown the blocks, and I started writing music to these sections, these themes. And there's also some source music in the film. There's a lovely piece, improvisation that Keith Jarrett did on a pipe organ in East Germany back in the day when there was an East Germany. And there's a wonderful piece by, there's several, Ayobagada, there's an African piece, and there's a couple of other pieces in the film. And also Lisa Gerard came on board, and she and her writing partner, Marcello Di Francisi, wrote some music to a couple of the themes also.
Now, for people who have never seen this kind of a film before, do you have any comments on what they should expect or what kind of state of mind they can put themselves in to really receive a film like this?
Well, the story really goes on in the inside you could say within the inner life of the audience as they're watching the film, unlike a standard theatrical film where you have actors on screen and their different emotions being portrayed and there's a storyline. The storyline is really within each member of the audience. So the audience is really, I mean, you could say that they're just as much a part of it as the filmmakers were, because whatever they're watching, however the images flow together for them and how that speaks to them and their own stories that they have inside, that's what the film is really about.
I wanted to just congratulate you on the film's success, because it opened in New York 3 or 4 weeks ago, and it's been near the top of the box office charts for independent film ever since. It's really been people want to see this, something different, it seems like.
Yeah, I think there's a real thirstiness in audiences right now for this kind of film. It's a little different from what we're used to going to theaters to see, but it creates this kind of deep, profound sense. I was in New York and then in Seattle and then Los Angeles and San Francisco at the openings of the film over the last couple of weeks. And at the end of the film, the audiences are very silent, almost like everyone's in a meditative state. And it's wonderful then to go into that state and respond to the audiences and answer questions that people in the audience have about the film and about their experience. And, of course, we're really looking forward. Ron Fricke, the director, Mark Magidson, the producer, and myself will be at the premiere tonight at the Lenzig, and we're really looking forward to answering everyone's questions.
I think there's a lot of, in the media, there's a lot of people who kind of make generalizations about the state of minds of Americans today, and that we have short attention spans and that we're polarized and that we're video game addicted and coffee addicted and unhealthy and things like that. And then when a movie like this comes along and at the end everybody is in a meditative state, it makes you wonder about all those assumptions and makes you think maybe some of those things really need to be rethought, and that we're always on the border of something which is much deeper.
Well, I think that that depth, that beauty is around us all the time, but we've become such a media culture. I can remember when I first went to see the Star Wars film, and everybody was just raving about it and how great it was. But for me, it was cut. The cuts were happening kind of at the speed of television, and the more spacious movies, outer space movies that I'd seen in the past were like movies by Kubrick, where there was this kind of poetic, meditative sense of time, or Tarkovsky. I think that's absolutely true, that, you know, people in general and audiences, I mean, we have these capabilities of expanding into time and being sensitive and feeling in different ways, but we're usually not offered those opportunities by the media that we watch.
The film is called Samsara. It's at the Lenzig tonight at 7 o'clock, and then it has a run, Jason, at the CCA?
It will open theatrically on Friday. And it'll be a great opportunity to come tonight, just because the filmmakers will be there,
Yeah. And
it'll be on the Lenzig giant screen. But I'm sure it's going to be playing for a good long time at the CCA, too.
Which is also a nice screen and a nice place.
Of course, we love our theater. So, and it's a really special film. So,
well, we look forward to seeing it, and we look forward to meeting you. Michael Stearns is the composer for the music of the film Samsara. Jason Silverman is director of the CCA Cinematheque, and we will see you and all of our listeners out in Radioland at the Lenzig tonight at 7 o'clock. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Jason.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program novelist and poet Anya Ochtenberg. She is author of the new book Blue Earth, and she will be speaking tonight and signing books at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So this is a novel set in Minnesota, where you live.
Yes.
And have put down some roots over
couple.
The years. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's a story of a farmer and yet another farm crisis in the history of 20th century America, namely that time in the 80s when a lot of people lost their farms.
Yes. Yes. And it's also, I mean, it struck me, I'm not from Minnesota, I'm a New Yorker. Agriculture for me was growing the top of a carrot in a milk container. So, but I was always I was extremely fascinated by Minnesota when I first went there, in part also because so many people lived in houses and had land and had a car and a yard and this kind of thing. And coming from New York, from where I'm from, the idea of owning anything or of having a place that was indeed in some way yours was certainly very attractive and also very confusing. And I was there a long time ago, and I went back, and I was doing research and ended up living there for a period, though I may not stay. But what always comes forward is the same story and effect that comes forward in many places, but is very particular to the United States in the theft of the land from Native peoples, the genocidal policies against them. And so in Minnesota, there's a very central event, which apparently a lot of people don't even know about. And that is most of the land was taken, close to 40 million acres were taken between 1851 and 1858, and the treaties had provided for food and money and all kinds of things. And were, of course, broken. And when people were starving, the native peoples were starving, the Dakota were starving, and the traders, all food was warehoused and people were turned away. Indeed, there was a trader named Trader Myrick who, when some Dakota people came to him and said, look, you know, we our people are starving, he said, a quote, basically, let them eat grass or their own dung. And so that was a sort of a last straw, a really nice guy. And so there, things happened as things do.
He came to an unhappy end,
yes,
shall we say.
He did.
That readers might say was well deserved.
It seems so. But it just the way that, and then the Dakota. Many Dakota rose up, and it was a very, very difficult situation, and people were very torn, but people were killed. Many Dakota were killed. Many of the white settlers were killed. And there were many Dakota arrested. About 304 were condemned to death, and Lincoln commuted most of that. And the trials were sort of, 5 minutes, you're guilty, kind of a trial.
Yeah.
So 38 Dakota were hung at the same time in the largest mass execution in the United States in 1862 in Mankato, Minnesota. Mankato comes from the Dakota word Makata, which means blue earth because of copper deposits in the rivers that turn this beautiful clay blue-green.
Right.
So my question always is, where are we standing and what sits in people? What of the larger history and what of the individual histories sit in people, and how does that form them and how does that deform them, and if there's an amnesia about it? And so it's a kind of it's really looking at how that sits in this character carver, who's not always who's not a nice guy.
No, he's not very nice.
But he's not Hitler, but he's really...
He lost his land.
He did. He's very pissed off. And he moves to the cities. He becomes obsessed because his wife leaves him taking their little girl. And he becomes obsessed with a beautiful little girl named Angie, who's the daughter of a working class couple who have been really bruised by a life of toil, and really sweet, really good people.
And he saves her life at some point early on, and for some reason makes her keep it a secret.
Yes.
And then becomes obsessed with her for the rest of the book.
Yeah, he does. And of course, when she, as she grows up, and she and her family become very close to a woman and her nephew, who are Dakota, and Carver cannot put this into his vision of the world. And she herself, the little girl herself, is a part Dakota from her father's side.
Right.
But there's so that whole question of and she doesn't, quote, look it, and so Carver just can't bear it. And it's, and part of it is just his coming to terms with the world that is, and the way, and his own history, his family history, and his sort of place in the world that has to do with this history of Minnesota. And it's a,
well, there's a big irony to it, because he's pretty overtly racist,
yes,
against the Indian people, and yes, and can't bear the idea that this young woman is romantically interested in this young Indian man,
yeah,
who's very nice. We like
right,
him. The readers like him very much. We'd like her too.
Yeah.
And but Carver, your protagonist, just can't stand it. And when you think about it, he's got a lot in common with them, because the white people took away the land from the Indians, and the bankers took the land,
yes,
away from him.
Yes. And this is what's so sort of painful and moving, because the more research I did and people I spoke to, I mean, I understood that farming was difficult. I didn't understand how incredibly dangerous it was, for instance, that there were clinics set up. They were so used to people hacking off a limb in their work that clinics were set up nearby so they just could, you know, put it back on. And so, you know, it's incredibly dangerous, incredibly difficult. All kinds of cancers came out of, you know, using of pesticides and that kind of thing, which has affected one of the other characters, Angie's
right,
mother. So it, you know, it was trying to just bring forward a larger picture, because the pictures are so often very separate, and so there's not the sort of imaginative space for, well, how does we all these people live in the same world, and how, what does that mean for, with all the separations, and how is that history shared and intertwined, and all of that without losing the sight of the workings of power,
right,
and what that's meant. So it's you know, I mean the book came in part, it was going to be a short story.
And it got away from you?
It did. And that Carver wasn't even there at the beginning.
You're kidding.
No, I had nothing to do with such a person. There was not...
Yeah, almost every time I talk to a fiction writer, they talk about characters just walking in unbidden.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't... I mean, I am a Jewish daughter of immigrants who lost various people and this guy is a German-American Lutheran farmer. I mean, I've been sort of in diaspora and in my own sort of exile and moving around. People who know me know I have a lot of addresses. And so there's Carver, and they've had the land for 150 years, and with that sort of sense that nothing existed before. And this is, of course, a story that is repeated all over the world, the successive displacements from the land.
Right.
And so I think in that sense it's an important story. And it's also, very few people in the United States know that specific story about the Dakota conflict and the mass execution.
Yeah, I didn't know until I read the prologue.
Yeah, yeah. And so it seems to me a central story to this country, and also that global story that, I mean, I don't even... You know, there are various places where that successive displacement is the entire story of that place, you know.
And it's a story of, without sounding too, I don't know what, but it's a story of healing.
Uh-huh.
It's a story of healing, yes, from personal and social afflictions, mm-hmm, that affect one's mind and soul.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's... it's very... I read the text of the world, and it's very, very important to understand one's own afflictions in context, one's own pains in context, and that idea, I'm always kind of coming up against the cutoff point, the border, that, well, this is important because this was recent, and that, you know, that didn't happen, or that's not important, or that, and there's just enormous amnesia, certainly about, you know, where this country comes from in terms of its land, its resources, its labor, and where its wealth came from. And
there's a moment where this woman, Dakota Indian, who has this very amiable nephew, says to Carver in when he's in a really bad way, bad state of mind, you are a repeater.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, and by which she means he's just doing bad things by rote without thinking why he's doing them and without really having even any good reason for doing them. And it's, to me, like he's a repeater, but we're also cultural repeaters.
Yes, yes. And that, I mean, that, I don't know where that sort of, the naming of it came from, but it felt to me quite important. And that this was somebody, you know, sort of running in circles and following his own tail. That, and one can see also, I mean, he was described as heinous by an editor in New York. And I'm sort
really?
Of like, yeah, she said, you know, your writing's really nice, but this guy is so heinous, people can't deal with it. I'm like, but did you read the papers today? Did you look out there? There's a lot of heinous thingies going on out there. So, you know, that the way that he did walk in, because it was really about Barb and Angie, and Barb is someone who's sort of, who came off the farms, who worked at Honeywell in Minneapolis.
Making cluster bombs.
Exactly, yeah.
And got sick from it.
Yeah, and didn't, you know, and was just, was a good person who, that was the first job she ever had really off the farm. And it was an extraordinary thing, in a sense, to be freed from the labor of the farm. And didn't know until she knew.
Yeah.
And acted on it when, you know, when she knew. Yeah. So.
Well, it's a gripping read.
Thank you.
Very beautifully written.
Thank you.
The book is called Blue Earth by Anya Ochtenberg. And you will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight
yes.
at 6 o'clock.
Yes.
Now, has this book been well received so far?
It has. I started with a reading in Minnesota. This is early in a kind of long series of book tours through the year, but I started at a reading at Subtext Books in St. Paul and expecting perhaps tomatoes because I am a little Jewish girl
from
Brooklyn. Yeah, what the heck? And it was, the discussion after was quite moving to me because people really have found this to echo their experience and to pull forward from them things that they have thought about and haven't wanted to think about. And so far so good. And I'm going to be doing some hard traveling with it. So thank you.
Well, Anya Ochtenberg, we look forward to seeing you tonight at Collected Works at 6 o'clock.
Thank you.